Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse. And this is the addendum. Different wars, different experiences, different heroes. Starting July 30th at 4 o'clock on The Voice of Vashon is the final series on the war in Vietnam and the addendum to the several series on war and the men who fought those wars. My voice is only narrating those powerful voices. While I feel we use the term heroes far too loosely, and sometimes it sounds sterile, these three men that I interviewed for this closing series are true heroes in very different ways. At the same time, I think they would refer to themselves as just doing the job. As we explore their lives in more detail through these interviews, I think that the heroic deeds will become apparent. The three are Brigadier General Joe Ulatowski. Joe was born and raised in Stanford, Connecticut, and then enlisted in the Army as a 17-year-old private during the latter stages of World War II. Also, Colonel Joe Schweitzer, who was an officer in the U.S. Army Corps and served during the Iraq Shield and also the war in Iraq. He worked as a command of soldiers at the company battalion and brigade level. And our third interviewee is Chris Anderson. I describe Chris as a local musician on Vashon, retired decorated Vietnam War veteran who gives back to the community of Vashon daily. He is a quiet and unassuming veteran who has contributed so much to other veterans and to his community. So with that, Chris is here with me. Chris, welcome.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
Good.
My wife is going to really think it's funny that you said I was quiet. And if you're listening, Sue, he was just kidding.
Yes. And talk in close like that. That's good. So what years were you in Vietnam?
I was in Vietnam 1966-67.
And those really were the years when, here we are, professional radio on all this, right?
Yeah, right.
I graduated in 66.
Uh-huh.
And those were the years, 66 to 68, that where the buildup was.
Right.
I mean, if you look at Vashon, that's where everybody, in my graduating class, most of the guys lived in Ellensburg, didn't have deferments, were going to work on the farm with their fathers.
Right.
So they graduated in June, went to Fort Lewis.
Right.
And we're in Vietnam by...
In four months,
by October.
Yep.
And where were you at that time?
I was in L.A.
Uh-huh.
I lived in L.A. and I got a draft notice when I was 18 because I had some issues and they decided the best place for me would be military. And I had no idea what it was, but I just went. Went down to L.A. and I left from there and went to Texas in the first airplane ride I've ever had in my life.
Yeah, and I think about that time was about the first time I ever had an airplane ride.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you took an airplane ride in 1966, you either had a lot of money and your parents were taking you to Disneyland, or you were drafted in
those days, the airplanes, you had to wear the, the safety stuff, the float in your seat, half of them, didn't they go down during those days?
Right.
It was
right.
Dangerous, standing on the planes.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't very good. No.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things I think that strikes me when I've gotten all these pictures from all these veterans that we've interviewed is that it's like everybody's smiling. And I guess part of that is, you get a picture taken, what's your first reaction? You smile, but all these folks, all these veterans that I saw in Vietnam, they're all smiling. And I think I asked one gentleman, I said, why were you all smiling? And he said, we didn't know what the hell was coming. Is that a pretty good way to describe it?
Well, that's one thing. And the other thing is that when the pictures are taken, you're not in combat.
Right.
So you're in the back area. And even if it's for a week or a day that you're not driving a convoy or whatever it is that people had to do in those days, you're free. And so you will smile a little bit more. I'm sure they weren't smiling in a gunfight.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably true. What was, I've asked everybody this question. What was your first, when you, did you come by plane to Vietnam or did you come by boat or?
You're asking me a leading question. I'm going to be serious now, and I will not kid you. I came by a plane, landed at Saigon, got out of the plane. It was 150 degrees. And
that was my next question.
Because yeah, it was 100. And all the people seemed to be small, and I didn't get it. What am I doing here with all these folks? And then I was there. What can I say? I mean, it's just a shock. Get in a plane, you get off, and you're there.
Yeah, and I remember almost everyone to a T that I've asked that have gotten off the plane, I said, what was your first impression like? And it was exactly that.
Yeah.
That the temperature and the humidity just hit me like a brick. And also the smell of diesel. You know, the being around that airbase and someone else said rotted vegetation.
Well, it'd be more like the rotted vegetation because there was a certain food that was being cooked all around that what we were not used to the smell of.
Yeah.
So there was that. But it was primarily looking at a population of people that since that time have discovered a lot about them. But at that point in time, they just looked like foreign small people. And what am I doing here?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But I didn't question it. It was just, that's okay.
And where did you do your training?
In Texas.
Okay.
In a place called Fort Bliss.
I've heard of Fort Bliss. Yes, yes.
Yeah. I mean, really, consider the humor.
Yes,
Fort
yeah.
Bliss.
Bliss doesn't exactly
describe
the
first time I was
it.
Ever in a sandstorm where you couldn't see the soldier in front of you doing training was there in that place.
In that place, yeah, yeah. And what did you train? What was your area that you were training
for? We were all training to kill people.
Yes, right.
To stab them with this big knife. None of us got it. You know, it was a lot of people from L.A., New York, and different places like that, and we didn't really understand what it was all about. I mean, we couldn't see ourselves killing anybody or anything like that. We were not gung-ho. We were kind of looking to either drink or smoke pot or something that we could get away with, and we had no idea what was coming. Not a clue.
Were there any other friends that you met in training that you were also placed with when you were out?
No, I was on my own.
Okay. Yep. And so then when you, where did you go from that point?
I went to Pleiku, which is in the Central Highlands. And what was happening at the time was it was the big LBJ 500,000 soldiers. I guess the idea was that if we put a soldier on every square foot of the country, we would have a chance, small as it might be, of actually, let's put quotes around the word winning, this particular ridiculous exercise. But so they didn't really have any place to put us. Not really. They just shoved us all over there. And I ended up in Pleiku as an armor eventually, but I had to survive all that because otherwise a lot of guys that came in like me went right into the jungle with no training.
Right into the jungle.
Right into the jungle with no training, just filling the numbers. If First Cav lost 40 men that night, 40 people filled those positions and they gave them the backpack and put them in the jungle with a gun.
And you were, at a camp in Pleiku.
I was in a place called Camp Holloway, which was a airbase. Basically, it's Army airbase that did reconnaissance and had helicopter Chinooks, things like that.
Okay, and so when you got there, what did they tell you you were going to do? Did they?
that's a good leading question.
Well, what sergeant, are you going to do?
The sergeant told me I was going to be in a talent show. That night. That was the first thing they told me because I had a guitar and I don't know how I got it. I have no idea how I had it, but I had
I know you have talent now.
Oh, yeah,
but,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so that was the first thing. I didn't even have a job. I went up and got on the stage with 1,000 really angry males drinking pretty heavily, and I sang the Phil Oakes song, Draft Dodger Rag. And it was, they loved it. And it was a great experience. Unfortunately, I had to do another song and I didn't have one and they booed me. So like, hey, if you get booed by 1,000 angry GIs, you figure everything else is up from there.
Yeah. And your name wasn't Bob Hope, so
no.
It didn't exactly cut
funny
it
funny, well, you mentioned that they would bring these shows around, and most of us would go to every one because we'd want to look at the women, just to see the dancers and whatever.
Right.
We couldn't care. But when Roy Rogers and Dale Evans showed up, nobody went.
Oh, is that right?
No. What? I don't want to look at a horse.
You don't want to say trigger? You know. Yeah.
Anyway, that was an odd part of Vietnam, was the entertainment business over there.
I think a lot of the, you know, interesting too, a lot of the entertainers, I think were really pretty, from what I understand, really pretty dedicated. In that respect, I mean, one of my friends who's a veteran, used to live on the island. He flew C-5,
Transport planes.
And he said he flew around Anne Margaret one time. Said she was just absolutely the nicest person in the world.
Oh, I thought you said he flew his plane around Anne Margaret. Yeah. I was trying to visualize Anne Margaret standing on the ground and a giant plane flying around.
Well, maybe a helicopter, right?
I don't know. I would have been in the plane flying around Anne Margaret myself.
That's right. And apparently he was... He did see her later, and she signed a book for him at a Costco, and she remembered that flight. So,
good.
Yeah. So then, where after that, you they sent you out, right?
And what I did was, I had to find a place outside of the jungle. So I told them I could type. So I became a kind of a person in that office, but I didn't type. So I had to fake my way through this and that. I became an armorer and a convoy driver. And that's how I spent the time in Vietnam, driving convoy and taking machine guns, 50 caliber, different things, and doing guard duty and things like that. But I didn't actually go in the jungle, no.
You weren't in the jungle.
I only went through it in a truck.
Uh-huh. And so were you in a situation where you were in combat very often, or were you just kind of watching out for everything?
Well, nothing happened for about 4 months, nothing at all. And then we got attacked all of a sudden in the middle. It just happened. And so combat comes in seconds.
Pleiku was attacked?
Camp Hollywood was attacked. It was kind of a preview of the Tet offense that went the next year. It was January. So on my birthday, I caught shrapnel in my arm, and that's where I got the Purple Heart. Because they just bombed the whole place.
Mostly mortars and that kind of
thing? Mortars and rockets, yeah. But they were also inside the camp. And so they were going around like that. And, you know, being a 19-year-old in the dark with a rifle on my shoulder, thinking, oh, my God, am I supposed to kill somebody? And what am I supposed to do here? I was scared. And shadows and darkness bothered me for a long time after that.
Is that right?
Because we couldn't find, we didn't know where they were or what they were doing. They killed a bunch of people. And we didn't really know what to do. We were just kids. And that was the weird part. That was a weird night.
And
that was the first time.
And it doesn't sound like it was very organized. I mean, it just kind of all of a sudden happened.
Well, when it happens, we all had a place to go. And if you were popular like I was, you went to the ammo dump to guard. Because I had an authority problem, which doesn't work out well in the military.
No.
Funny, the two people you mentioned before me were both generals. I was a private.
Yeah, that's And so,
thank you for including me our side.
Yeah, yes. And how long? And you were there what? 13 months or
12 months to the day.
12 months to the day.
Yep. Yeah. Most of the people got out early, but again, authority. You know, not having a problem with authority leads to problems, and that was one. I stayed every single day.
Yeah.
And we got attacked 2 weeks before I was supposed to come home, too.
The same.
A different one, yeah. But it would come and go. You know, you never know. Sometimes they would sabotage, and they'd be inside. I mean, they were fighting for their lives, the people that lived there.
Right.
So the best part of this, and I know I'm using up time, and you know I talk too much.
No, you're doing just fine.
But there was a Cheech and Chong routine done once where they were sent out to find the enemy, and they come back to say, Sergeant, hey, Sergeant, we found the enemy. Well, okay, good. Well, they live here.
Yeah. Yeah. They're, really? Gee, and we don't, do we?
Yeah.
So it was weird. When I got back, I began to look at it, but I didn't during that time.
Yeah. And so when you came back, you came right back to L.A.?
Yes, right back to L.A. Right back to a gunfight in L.A. Directly back, walking into the house. There were guns everywhere. There was two gangs. My friends were in this one, and they got surrounded. And probably within 4 or 5 days after getting back from Vietnam, that happened.
Wow.
And I said, you know, I think it's time for me to leave. Yeah. It's crazy.
Which is, you know, isn't that kind of the example of from the frying pan to the fire?
Exactly. It's like, before we start criticizing and saying other countries are dangerous, let's look at ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and say, you know, what is this? You know, shootings and stuff. Anyway, we won't go into that. But yeah, that was weird. And I still remember my friend Hawk taking his rifle and going outside and shooting over the heads of the other people. And I went, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, almost more dangerous.
Because, you know, who's coming in those days was LAPD.
Right.
And they don't, you know, they don't care who you are. They're going to take you all in.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And so then what were your lasting effects that you kind of, you mentioned about the shadows and that kind of stuff.
Well, the lasting effect for me is the guilt of how I personally felt and treated the people over there and the population over there. I was convinced they were, I don't want to go into it, but anyway, there's a couple things that happened to me after that that made me realize that racism or whatever you want to call it in me came from places, and I had to face it and get rid of it. And so in the coop, on the wall of the coop, is a painting of a bird, and I take people over there and show them. It was done by a Vietnamese girl in my class in 1977, and I've had it on my wall wherever I've been, teaching whatever, ever since, to remind me these are human beings. And the army, the way they send you out is to create hate, create this attitude that they need to be eliminated.
You know, I don't know if you've listened to some of the other interviews, but in the second series, one of the things that I talked about, which we've always done, is we demonize. I don't care who we are, whether we're the Germans hating the, you know, there's
right.
You know, we demonize our enemy.
Except,
you know,
right.
We make them inanimate. We call them gooks. We call them
absolutely
slants.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. We call. Even in World War II, we call them Japs. We call the Germans Krauts.
Right. And you've got to remember that stays with you all your life. When you call somebody a slope or a gook or something like that, and then you come back and you start realizing, well, what's the difference between saying that or a black person or a Hispanic person? What's the difference? None. So where did it come from? It was actually instilled in me they would show us movies. They would show us. I mean, believe me, the propaganda was amazing.
And it's certainly a lot easier to kill an inanimate object as opposed to a live person. One person told me that they also said, you know, they were going out and they'd killed people in a firefight, and they were looking for memorabilia. They were looking for things,
right,
you know, souvenirs to take back. And the one guy says, I found this guy's wallet, and I thought, great. And then here's a picture of the guy with his family.
Yeah.
And he says, at that point, I realized that person was just like me, but from a different
absolutely
country, fighting for a different cause.
Actually fighting for their own country. And the funny thing about it is that we don't ever look at people as human. I mean, we're always, look at what's going on now with a certain candidate in this particular office that we have, to demonize a group of people, to get other people to say, yeah, that's why I want to get rid of them, whoever they are.
Right.
And it's insane, because the world is too small for that now.
And, you know, very few people are all of one, you know, one
culture
or one,
no,
you know,
I know.
I'm reading a book right now, and it's talking about, and it really makes a lot of sense to me, that when we describe someone as a liberal, or a progressive or a Democrat or a Republican or whatever, a MAGA American or whatever we call them, we also limit our views of them in that we assume that if a person meets this little pigeonhole, that they're all one way, and very few people are, if that makes sense.
It's a survival thing. Okay,
yeah.
Especially in a combat situation, you can't have any kind of empathy, I imagine, for people that you're supposed to do something violent to. But fortunately for me, for the most part, I just kind of rode the pines like many people do. Nine out of ten vets don't actually get into combat battle situations. World War II might have been different, but lately, you know, they're able to do it with drones, and they're able to do it now. And, you know, it's weird. It's just strange.
Well, I know one person was telling me if they'd had, you know, drones along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the Joe Schweitzer, who we interviewed, you know, it'd been a totally different issue.
I don't know. I was talking to a woman just 2 days ago, and she looked, I thought she was Polynesian anyway. She turned out to be Vietnamese, because I was telling her I was in Vietnam, and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry." That's what she said to me, and I said, "Yeah, I am too." And she said, "I was in the Mekong Delta." And that was a very dangerous place for when I was there. That was like one of the places where a lot of combat took place. Anyway.
Yeah.
So that brought it back again, human. This is a human person.
Yeah.
And she was there.
And I think some of the pictures that came back from Vietnam that showed the humanness that came back on our TV screen, you know, within 12 hours really showed that a lot. Let's also talk a little bit about, because, you know, and I know you're going to give me a rash for this.
Of course I am.
But, you know, I think, you know, I really described you as a hero just from the standpoint that you've come back and you've really, I think you've made a great impact on this. And I really mean this with all my heart, Chris. I think you've made a real impact on your community with the music and with the coop. And I think that's part of living on the island. I think that's part of living here.
Part of the community that you have here, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the community here is unlike any that I've ever been around, where they actually really walk the talk about tolerating each other and how they are and who's this and who's that and what kind of gender they have or what kind of a, you know, sexual orientation, however you say it. Here is an amazing place, and it's probably the eye of the storm.
Yeah, and I agree with you, and we're not perfect. And, you know, we can all think back on our lives when, you know, I can think back on my life when I used racial slurs when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about things differently, but I think it is a good feeling. Talk a little bit about the coop and why you got that set up.
Okay. The coop has come about through the efforts of many, many people, and I won't even mention them except for Sue, who is my partner, my wife, and she has been incredibly active in the coop. But what it is
you get marriage points for that.
I know. That's why I said
that's
it.
Recorded.
I mean, come on. I mean, the chances of her listening are not good, but, you know.
Oh, well, I'll record
just in
this
case.
For her. We'll play this, you know.
But
blasted outside the house.
But the coop has just been a place where people come to play. But let me say this, since the time is limited. I appreciate Steve Nurse for getting the coop to realize that it has to be accessible to the population of people that, for whatever reason, are in wheelchairs or even in walkers. Actually, Gordy Ryan, who's not in either, loves using the ramp to take his drums up and back. And we have to thank the Steve Nurse for bringing that into our lives, because I never thought about access to a place.
Yeah.
And you probably run into that all the time.
You know, it's funny because when I was going to graduate school, I had my professor wanted my two kids to come with me. And they wanted to talk in this graduate class about how it was having a father in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were looking for all these deep answers and, you know, are the kids giving you a hard time or whatever. And I remember my youngest daughter, Lisa, and they asked her, well, Lisa, how do you feel about having a father in a wheelchair? And her response was so kid-like. She says, well, we always get the good parking places. So, you know.
All right.
You know.
Yes.
I mean, that's how you bring it down to people. And I think that that's it. And I think what you're saying is that people don't think about these things.
Right.
You know, people aren't saying, we're going to do this, not to exclude these people, but we need to have that more, you know, awareness and everything.
Well, anyway, just a long shot. So you're a part of that. You've been a part of that. And everybody here has been by having a radio station. The Coop is just an extension of everybody's music and everybody's art and everybody's, you know, Sue's and her art. And it allows me to stay in the band at my advanced age, see? Because I have the stage, they have to let me at least play a song or two.
Yeah.
So, you know, or I'll take the stage away.
Yeah, that's right. And
I'll just pick it up and I'll take it into my corner and I'll pout.
And I think being able to hold that over everybody's head really has some value.
Because it weighs a lot.
Yeah, yes, it does.
Yeah.
And I really want to do one of these. My wife would cringe, but I really want to do one of these theme nights.
You should.
And you can play guitar for me.
I'll do whatever you want.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's
take
good.
It through Steve Amsden.
Yeah, and just for me, yeah. And just make sure that, you know, that we, I'm kind of thinking a Big Rock Candy Mountain, but, you know.
The theme for, his theme for August, I'm not in the July because we're going to be gone, but his theme for August will be songs with women's names in it. So just consider.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I know there's barely any.
Yeah.
Barely any. I'm hardly any. In fact, you know, I just have to look forever to find one.
And my old girlfriend, Barbara, you know, and I used to sing this song by Bobby V. Uh-huh. Please don't ask about Barbara. Don't ask me if she's found somebody new. Because if I...
Ladies and gentlemen, Steve
I'll try to smile.
Sings us to the end of the show. Thank you, Steve, for those golden tones. Rick is impressed with that.
Yes, that's right. Well, we'll do that. And Rick, what we're going to do now is Rick is going to... we're going to play one of Chris's songs. This is called American Hero. And this is a song that he wrote. Anybody wants to copy it?
Can, yeah, sure.
They can.
Yep.
And those proceeds go to the Steve Nurse Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Uh-huh.
And so...
We make a wish that Steve Nurse would do what? No, I get it. I mean, we've been doing a thing at the Coop for veterans housing for the housing, and that'll be important too.
Yeah.
But anyway,
and we've been giving you've been getting money for them, and that's important.
Yeah, we do square dancing, poetry, you name it.
And so I just want to let everybody know as we go here that we've been interviewing Chris Anderson from the Coop and. From L.A. and every other place he's
ever
been.
And other parts in between.
And they all make up what Chris Anderson is today. And we will play his song in its entirety for you about his experiences in Vietnam. And we hope you enjoy it. So thank you, everybody, and good day.
He could easily self-destruct, end up in a steel bar cage, sees the enemy all around, in his heart there's a burning rage. Lives out the days alone, smoking alcohol by the glass, looks normal on the surface, in the street. Living the past, American hero on a winter's day, standing in the sun. Watch the parade, American hero, story's too old. He was young once, with a smile on his face. The world was sunny and future bright. Government took him, 19 years old, sent him away to a rich man's fight. American hero on a winter's day, stand in the sun, watch the parade. American hero, losing control. His soul scattered his youth into the wind. Time bomb planted deep inside waits for a spark to begin. American hero. Sits alone back in the shadows, waiting patiently for light. His sleepless eyes are chained to darkness, just wants to make it through the night. American hero on a winter's day, stand in the sun. Two veterans commit suicide every day, and I guess the rest just get in the way. Thank you for your service, words on a sign. I read them for hours and hours in the VA line. As I took a number, it was plain to see the kind of joke played on